Bruce this hour. A brand new book written by Peter Ames Carlin. And it's unusual because Peter had access to Bruce, who spoke pretty openly about many parts of his life. The book covers Bruce Springsteen's life from birth through 2011. I found fascinating years growing up in a very odd, on-the-fringe family in a working-class town of Freehold, New Jersey. An extremely dysfunctional relationship with his father, which changed after his father had a stroke. And Springsteen's kind of interesting life. He didn't like school very much. He was a great writer. He had a teacher who I think was very important in his life. And once he found the guitar, that was it. He was known to practice as many as 10 hours a day. Can you imagine that, playing the guitar for 10 hours a day? Peter Ames Carlin has written about other highly visible performers. He is the author of Catch a Wave, The Rise and Redemption of the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson, Paul McCartney, A Life. He's been a senior writer for People and a TV critic for The Oregonian. We'll be welcoming phone calls and, of course, listening to some Bruce, the boss, during the course of this hour. Here's how you can reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Peter, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. I found the early years really interesting in his life. I like people's early years, no matter who they happen to be. But the whole grandparent situation and his parents' situation, it's an understatement to say it was a rather odd family, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a very haunted family in a lot of ways. Bruce's father's family had immigrated to the U.S. or to the New World at the time in the 17th century. They were, you know, as early immigrants as you could possibly be, and had lived in New Jersey almost ever since, and largely in Monmouth County, which is that the county where in New Jersey that takes in both Freehold and Asbury Park, which is 20 miles east on the beach. But you know, over the generations, they'd always been working class people, and you know, going up right through the 19th and 20th centuries. But there was a kind of that little twist of mental illness that sort of hid in their DNA. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of very kind of haunted characters. And when Bruce's father was a little boy, his sister was out playing on her tricycle and was killed in an accident with an oil truck. And it devastated Doug Springsteen's parents, and he grew up in this very sad and very sort of ghostly household that was just, you know, kind of spooked by these portraits of this dead older sister who had been the most treasured child. And so this absence not only dominated Doug's life, but also when Bruce was born, the grandparents latched onto him as though he were the replacement for the child they had lost 22 years earlier. You know, and so he grew up as this combination kind of replacement child, the sort of golden boy to his grandparents, but also this sort of understanding the depth of their loss and dealing with, you know, the odd kind of dysfunctions and patterns of behavior that had essentially dominated their lives.
Mm-hmm. And there's such a dramatic change in his father, but imagine having your father sitting at the kitchen table hour after hour after hour, smoking cigarette after cigarette and drinking beer after beer every single night.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, I mean, you'd think, well, you know, he's an alcoholic, and that's where Bruce's problems are. But his father, actually, Douglas, who we were talking about a second ago, was manic depressive. I mean, that was part of, you know,
right.
He really kind of got the, you know, the worst end of you know, that DNA curl I was talking about a second ago. So he was, you know, tormented by this illness, which was undiagnosed for the bulk of his life. And had a very difficult time getting from day to day and holding on to a job. I mean, people talk about, you know, Bruce has always talked about his dad's, you know, being fired and being unemployed and having to get a new job and really suffering at the workplace. And, you know, to Bruce, you know, obviously, you know, those kinds of factory jobs, you know, not necessarily the most, soul-inspiring, I suppose. But poor Douglas's soul had always been twisted by this illness that he had. And that was something that really tormented Bruce in a lot of ways, because his father had a very difficult time connecting with him, and Bruce was just crushed by the absence of that relationship.
And it was in psychotherapy for years and years and years, in large measure because of his dad, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a combination of things. I mean, you have the nurture part where, you know, that scene you talked about, that kind of primal scene in the kitchen at night, when Doug would sit there, you know, at the end of a working day or at the end of whatever kind of day he'd had, and self-medicate, really, because, you know, he wasn't getting any treatment at all, by, you know, drinking a six-pack of beer and smoking cigarettes and sitting in the dark just to, you know, to contemplate the sort of darkness in his soul, I suppose. And that was how he got himself, you know, through his day and into, you know, his dreams, whatever they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that really sort of pried him apart from the family.
And then, getting to the end of the book, because it's so dramatic, his father has a stroke, and all of a sudden he becomes this highly sentimental, emotional guy who asks Bruce to sit on his lap.
Right. Which is a little weird.
It is. It's a little weird.
It's not like he turned into Mr. Rogers or whatever. But I mean, and he was never a terrible guy. Douglas Springsteen was always a lovely guy, very warm and sweet guy, but just sort of hidden behind this terrible wall, you know, that he couldn't get past. And after he had been very sort of uncommunicative, especially when it came to emotions. But after he had this stroke, and I think around 1979. For whatever reason, it changed, you know, the neurotransmitters or whatever in his brain to the extent where suddenly he couldn't hide his emotions. I don't know if that, you know, so like when something came up that touched him, he would burst into tears. I don't know that it effectively cured the relationships and made him a happy, well-adjusted man, but it definitely altered his patterns in a serious way.
Mm-hmm. You think about rock and roll bands having access, and many of them avail themselves of use of lots of drugs and smoke cigarettes, and there's a lot of sex involved. Bruce Springsteen was pretty much, maybe because of his father, a straight arrow, didn't smoke, didn't do much drinking, didn't do drugs.
Oh, yeah. Well, from his teenage years on, I mean, he was all about control, because I think he felt in his family with his father that there was a very that they were always on the edge of hurtling out of control, because you never knew what Doug was going to do from day to day or what was going to happen around the house. And so like most kids, I think, who feel out of control, you know, or a certain percentage of them anyway, Bruce decided to become the guy whose feet were always going to be on the ground, who was never going to be, you know, unable to make, you know, strong, intelligent decisions and maintain control over his position and who was around him. And so he really, you know, even during the hippie era, when he had long hair and big sideburns and the cops always thought he was just another freak, you know, the hippies thought he was a freak too, because he never wanted to drink or get stoned,
right,
or any of that stuff. So he kind of had it bad from both ends of the spectrum there. But, eventually he sort of grew into, you know, by the time he hit his early 20s, I think he began to experiment a little bit with having a drink every now and then. And, and he definitely, I mean, he's a social drinker, so, you know, sometimes he'll go out and have a couple, and sometimes, you know, if something big's going on, he might go out and have a big night and have more than a couple.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's like, he didn't have a problem with it. It's just, he just drinks like other people do.
Let's talk about the first guitar, the one that his mother, Adele, bought for him, and she made great sacrifices for him. She was kind of his rock, wasn't she?
Yeah, you know, a lot of those sacrifices sort of went back to that relationship with his grandparents, who treated him like a sun god, I think, because they essentially subsumed the parents' role. Much to the, you know, to the great dismay of Adele Springsteen, Bruce's mother, and probably to Doug as well. I mean, though Adele was more about, she was a complete rock in his life, as you said. But, you know, when Bruce wanted stuff, Bruce tended to get stuff. Even, you know, even though his folks were very lower working class and didn't have a lot of extra money, you know, when Bruce really got turned on to something like a guitar, his mother found a way to make it happen. And when he first got interested in Elvis in the mid-60s, they rented him a little acoustic guitar that was hard to play, and he set it aside. But then when the Beatles showed up in 1964, suddenly he was, you know, on fire, and they got another acoustic for him, which he devoted himself to almost entirely. And then by the end of that year, he begged to get this first electric guitar, and his mother, got a loan, like a payday loan type thing, and bought him the $68 Japanese guitar that, that he played religiously. And as you said, would sit in his room for 6, 8, 10 hours a day.
Goodness.
Nothing but play the guitar.
Goodness. You know, I'm reminded of Ed Sullivan, and you remind us of Ed Sullivan, where he saw Elvis Presley and also hearing the Beatles on the radio. Can you tell those stories? Because he was so excited by both experiences.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we talked about Elvis a lot, and he goes on and obviously a lot of his analysis is in retrospect, but he said, for an outsider kid like he was, who was shy and felt, sort of on the fringes or beyond the fringes of society, to see this guy come on, to see this guy come on TV dressed in incredibly gaudy, strange clothes, with his hair combed in a way no one combed it, jumping around like a maniac and singing these songs, with this incredible command. The whole rest of the world seemed to vanish, and it was this one guy making his own rules and recasting society in his image, and as Bruce was saying, it was like a new kind, it was like the arrival of a new kind of man, and that this thing that had separated you from the rest of society was now going, you were going to transform that into the thing that was going to draw the rest of society to you. And to him, that was a revelation, almost beyond all revelations. Hmm. And inspired by that, he took, that was sort of, I think, the essential moment that led to his determination to throw himself into music that intensely, because he saw it as his only, the way he was going to rebuild his life. It was all about reinvention. And I think it was only, doubled down by seeing the Beatles a few years later, or at first hearing them on the radio. I mean, he described being in the front seat of his mom's car when she had picked him up from school and was taking him somewhere, and hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand on the radio for the first time, and just feeling pinned back in his seat and listening to it on his way, over to where his mom was taking him. And when he leaped out of the car, he ran over to the nearest phone booth and slammed inside and called his girlfriend and said, "Have you heard this? Did you hear that?" And he said it was like, again, it was that feeling that the whole rest of the world stopped and there was only these guys and that song.
Let's take a phone call here. Our number, by the way, we're talking about Bruce Springsteen this hour of the program, The Boss. Our guest is the author of Bruce, which has just recently been released and is unique among biographies of Bruce in that Peter had access to him and they had long conversations and he opened up about his life, which in this book covers his whole life from when he was born until 2011. Peter Ames Carlin is the biographer. Our number is 800-486-8655, and let's go to Scott in Verona. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. How are you folks doing today?
Fine. How are you, Scott?
I'm all right. I'm from Monmouth County, New Jersey. My
parents
grew up with Bruce.
Cool.
There's stories that Bruce used to play in somebody's Italian restaurant when he was a kid on Friday nights after school for money.
Well, that sounds like it could be true. I mean, I never heard tales of a particular Friday afternoon gig or whatever, but he played a lot of places in Freehold. I mean, his favorite Italian place there is Federici's Pizza, and he's, I think he's been a regular there since he was in a Little League baseball player in the mid-60s, the early 60s, actually. He could have brought his guitar there. I don't know. I mean, he's played a lot of different places around there. They all know him real well.
Yeah.
He's just a great kind of person. I mean, he's down to earth. He's very a loving guy. I mean, my parents and him and everybody used to hang out at the Stone Pony in Asbury Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then back in 86, I just happened to be sitting in the Stone Pony. You know, there was a band playing, and next thing you know, Bruce walks in the back door, sits in, plays a couple songs with the band, and then leaves. That's just the kind of person he is.
Yeah, no, he loves that. I mean, the Pony, especially during the 70s and I think the first half of the 80s, was like his living room to a great degree, because he would go and just, you know, it's where his people he knew were going to be. It's where people, you know, they had known him for a long time, and there was a lot of warmth and affection, but not all, you know, but I think, you know, not like crazy hero worship, or, you know, or maybe, you know, a smaller extent of that. But he would go and hang out and play with the bands if they wanted him to play with them, which, of course, you know, generally I think they always did. And if it got super busy, you know, and he'd had a couple cocktails, he'd jump behind the bar and help bartend, which was less help than he might have intended, because, as it turns out, he didn't know how to mix any drinks, and he really wasn't interested in making change. So sometimes, as the owner told me, that Bruce would, you know, somebody would hand, you know, buy a couple drinks and hand him a $10 bill, and he'd give them like $27 in change or something, you know. So, but the guy said he didn't care. The owner said he didn't care, because it, you know, it paid for itself eventually, because everyone was so excited to have Bruce there.
Thank you, Scott, very much for the call. We all have parts of ourselves that are not as wonderful as other parts, and we'll talk to Peter about his name, The Boss, how he got the name The Boss, and if, as boss, really, of the E Street Band, he was less than friendly at times, if he could be a difficult guy, because there is a part of him that, because of who he was and what he was trying to create, perhaps was not as encouraging. People in the E Street Band have said that he got all the glory and they didn't get as much. What was his relationship with members of the band? We'll talk to Peter about that. And welcome your phone calls. You may have a favorite Bruce Springsteen song and would like for us to talk about it with Peter. And maybe if you pick something on our list, we'll be able to play your particular song. Or you've seen him in concert, I guess. I've never seen him in concert. I guess he gives absolutely marvelous, full-energy concerts. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bruce Springsteen and Rosalita come out tonight. Is there a backstory to that song that we should know about, Peter?
Oh, of course.
Of course.
He was living for a while. He had a very serious girlfriend in the early 70s named Diane Lizito, who actually, oddly, lives in Oregon now. One of my neighbors, sort of.
No.
A neighbor, but nevertheless. And so they were very, very hot and heavy, had this very sort of passionate, stormy kind of relationship, but he wrote a lot of great songs about her. Rosalita is about her, and seeing as her name was, you know, I mean, you know, the Lizito part you can hear, and I think she had a grandmother and an aunt named Rosie Lizito. So it was like that. There were other songs. I think Sandy was written about her. There's a one of the great outtakes from that era called Thundercrack is definitely written about her, Spirit in the Night and like that. So Rosalita was really just, you know, one of those great kind of celebration songs, you know, which about escape and triumph and, you know, heading west and finding this dreamy place on the Golden Coast.
Mm.
Where they play guitars all night and all day.
Hmm.
And Bruce imagined it with Diane at his side.
Hmm. Scott was talking about how he's a regular guy, nice as can be. There is, of course, a side to all of us that isn't always nice. What about his treatment of E Street Band members? Was it less than nice?
Well, you know, I mean, it got complicated. Let's put it that way. Those guys have been playing together since they were kids, you know,
mm-hmm.
since they were teenagers. And, they really came up the hard way. All those years in bars, they didn't make money for the longest time. And there's a lot of sacrifices being made. Everybody always knew that Bruce was the main guy. You know, he wrote the songs, he was the front man, he was the lead guitar player, he was the band leader. He was sort of the guy they all kind of arrayed themselves around. And obviously that arrangement has worked out beautifully. But, you know, they also have their own feelings and they have their own sense of, their own identities and their strengths. And I think it's difficult for anyone to feel like an adjunct to another person, you know, and harder still when, you know, somebody is, you know, for all of Bruce's great qualities, and his art is obviously a huge one, you know, that requires a kind of self-involvement, and stardom requires a kind of, you know, not only self-involvement, but kind of self-celebration. You know, you have to sort of feed
right.
your ego to maintain your confidence in your art. And so that leads to this kind of, you know, especially with celebrities we see, this kind of cloistered life inside this sort of warm bubble. But you need other people to believe in you and to sort of treat you as though you were special. And so Bruce, you know, I mean, I think he understands this, that, as much as he likes to be a regular guy and do normal things, he isn't, you know. I mean, he does that stuff and he maintains his connection, but a lot of his time is spent being catered to because, you know, to be creative, he sort of needs to feel comfortable and cared for. And so that breeds a kind of narcissism.
Sure. Let's go to Joan in Williams Bay next. Hi, Joan.
Yeah, good afternoon. I think it's afternoon.
It's morning, actually, but what the heck.
I recall being in Chicago downtown and on the way home from work at one time that they were giving away tickets for a Bruce Springsteen concert downtown. Does anyone know anything about that? I always wanted to follow up to that. I might have missed a wonderful thing.
When was this, Joan?
By not taking the free ticket.
When was it? I'm sorry, Joan. When was
yes.
this?
When?
When was this?
Oh, well, I think it was in the 60s or 70s.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the moment that he achieved stardom and about his concert performances, because he's known to give terrific performances. When did somebody and who realized, here's an enormous talent, Peter?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, there were hints of that even back in the 60s when he was playing with, his early sort of pre-E Street band groups. There was a band that he formed in early 1969 that was called, eventually called Steel Mill. They had a slightly different name in the first few months of their career, but they played almost all original Springsteen music, this was around 69, 1970. They became huge around New Jersey and the East Coast. They could play they played these big outdoor shows at, you know, in parks and college campuses and draw, you know, 3,000, 4,000 people, which is a lot when you're a
sure.
local band that doesn't even have a record contract. And they developed some buzz in San Francisco and they went out there to spend a couple months in early 1970. And then it just didn't hold together, but I mean, people knew and there was a lot of stories written about this guy who was an amazing front man and wrote these incredible songs and was a hot guitarist. So he was kind of building up and kind of becoming a local star. But then when he finally made his move to New York and got a recording contract and put out his first couple records, that's when sort of the mainstream entertainment society sort of began to get the sense that these guys, that there was something really big going on with this guy from New Jersey. And there was a lot of very elite critics jumped on board his first and second records and began to really celebrate them even before, you know, and they were very, very low sellers. Hardly anybody heard of them back in those days. And he developed this very sort of tight and impassioned crew of apostles, practically, guys at Columbia Records, his manager, who were willing to sacrifice everything to further this guy's career. And it paid off, for everyone. And when Born to Run came out in 1975.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear some of Born to Run, and I'd like for us to listen to it and also talk about what he writes about, the lyrics. Here's 1975, one of his early hits, Born to Run. Poetic, isn't he? He's an accomplished writer, and I think maybe we don't appreciate that about him as much as we should. The words to the songs are very important, and I'm wondering about that part of his life that helped him develop those words. How did he learn to be a writer?
You know, I think he absorbed that. You know, he took some English classes in high school, and then when he went to college very briefly at community college, and in New Jersey, it was he studied, I think, literature almost entirely, and did very well in his classes. There was an English composition class, a creative writing class, where his mother showed me some of his papers, his essays and short stories.
She saved everything.
Oh yeah,
oh,
she's more proud
Mom.
Of those than they are of his Grammys, I think, or his gold records. Look, he got really good grades. So, look what she says. And he obviously had a feel for it. School didn't work for him for a variety of reasons. I think he felt out of place and uncomfortable. His family wasn't particularly intellectual. They're very intelligent people, but just not in that kind of academic way. At least, that wasn't sort of the place where they came from socioculturally. But eventually, he found his peace with it and then developed a burning curiosity and fascination for literature. But even as an early, in those early days when he still sort of resisted the idea of book learning, you can tell the guy's got this sort of just inherent genius. I mean, his ability to write in such a vivid language and to, to understand the depth and power of certain images and how to twist images to make them more clear. That comes through lines of Born to Run that we just heard, and the way, that very vivid way he has of describing these cars on the highway in New Jersey and the desperation young people in these small towns felt, this hunger to be somewhere, to be somewhere else, to escape the bounds of their heritage and recreate themselves.
Yeah.
And we heard it earlier in Rosalita, you hear it again in Born to Run. I mean, it exists, you still hear it in Bruce's songs now, but it's a very fundamental American idea, this idea of staking your claim and rebuilding yourself in your own image. And that's kind of, it's one of the great American themes that he's really picked up and translated for, his era, for his moment in time.
Let's hear another great American theme song that is so interesting, this song, because conservatives used it to tout their agenda, and others would say, wait a second, that's not what this song is about. Let's hear a song that people know all the words to this one. Here's Bruce, Born in the USA. Born in the USA, at which point Springsteen was so famous that even Ronald Reagan knew about him, didn't he, Peter?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I mean, at that point, with Born in the USA, it all, you know, it came together in this big mainstream way, you know, in part due to the fact that Bruce was ready to really become a huge, you know, not just famous, but, you know, a global superstar,
mm-hmm.
and kind of crafted that record to some degree and his image to some degree to become more accessible to that larger audience. But Born in the USA was this very, you know, a very complicated song in a
yes.
lot of ways, because it's got that big chorus that you can't get out of your head that sounds like it ought to be patriotic. But then you get into the verses, and they're,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're practically subversive, talking about how, you know, these guys who were born in the USA and sacrifice themselves to go to war and come back and are just treated, you know, terribly. So in other words, the chorus kind of contradicts or becomes kind of this darkly ironic commentary on this whole idea that the country treats its veterans, you know, in any kind of decent way. You know, and a very similarly structured song came out last year in We Take Care of Our Own, which was the lead
yes.
single to his latest record,
mm-hmm.
Wrecking Ball. And it's in the same way. It has this chorus where he says, we take care of our own. And that sounds very affirming until you listen to the verses, and they're all about the times and that point in history, you know, the 10 years leading up to that point, where the country hadn't really, you know, had failed to take care of people who were in trouble.
Right.
You know, and that was a huge thing. But again, it got, you know, people were saying, oh, well, it's a jingoistic anthem. You know, it's blindly patriotic. And it's like, well, no, you got to go past the chorus and listen to the verses, and then you realize exactly what he means, what his tone is in that chorus.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Linda in Larson. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thanks for having this show. This is wonderful. I wanted to just relate. The first time I saw Bruce, or I should say I heard Bruce, I was at a Marquette area house party in Milwaukee, and they had these huge speakers out on the porch, and I heard Rosalita. I'm like, oh, my gosh, who is this? This is amazing. And I wanted to just tell you, Kathleen, if you haven't seen him, that you've got to see him. There's nothing like a Bruce concert ever, ever, ever. And
oh, okay.
The last time I saw him was at Harley Rally, and it was a four-hour concert, and I saw him leave with his entourage and the limo, and I hope I get to see him one more time. It's just an amazing experience. So
thanks
for having the show.
Thanks, Linda. I should go see him. He does give incredible concerts, doesn't he? The stamina. He's not a real young guy anymore. He certainly takes care of himself. But to do four-hour concerts, oh, my gosh.
Well, the four-hour shows are pretty rare, actually. You know, people had always said over the years, like, oh, Bruce used to play these four-hour shows. You know, and as you said, you know, now he is 63, I think.
Yes, he
is. In incredible shape, amazing physical shape. But really, I think the very first actually recorded four-hour show came last spring. I think he was playing in Sweden or up around Scandinavia. And I think, you know, I think a lot of this tour, I mean, he's always been a very, very physical performer. You know, he's always just real. There's an intensity about his shows. You know, that I saw first when I saw him in 1978, I mean, I was just stunned by how emotionally overwhelming it was, because he was up there, and unlike other shows I'd seen up to that point, where there's a certain amount, you know, you could sort of see the seams of showbiz sneaking in to the side. There was nothing showbizzy about Bruce's show. There were no lasers, there was no smoke, you know, the guys weren't dressed all that fancy. It was just a bunch of guys up there, and Bruce in, you know, jeans and a t-shirt, you know, essentially, ripping into these songs like, you know, his life depended on it. Which
mm-hmm.
to a great extent it did, you know, and it went on and on and on, and he was, you know, looked like a wreck by the time it was over, you know, and but you know, that's the thing. I mean, that was kind of the, you know, we talked earlier about how he didn't do those sort of self-destructive things like take drugs or drink to excess, but his performances were sort of his excess in a lot of ways. I mean,
he
eventually came to understand this, because I think that communion with the audience was the one intensely passionate relationship that mattered to him the most, because he didn't feel, you know, it didn't, it was, he got the emotional charge he would have gotten out of a real sort of intimate romantic relationship, which he was less capable of having at the time, through this great crowd and the amount of energy they, and you know, essentially, you know, unqualified love they threw back at him over the footlights. And so it was the one place he had to go every day, and that's why he never wanted to leave the state.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, he obviously writes some songs that are very important to him, and I was very moved by the chapter that you write about, Streets of Philadelphia. Let me just read the beginning of it. He took up a request for him to write a song to go with a film about an age-stricken gay man confronted with institutionalized prejudice. And you write, Bruce need only think back to his childhood. Everything he needed to know already resided in his memory. The kids who giggled at his clothes, the distance between the schoolyard games and his solitary place against the fence. He knew that contempt, and its ashen taste never left his tongue. So came the Streets of Philadelphia, and he wound up... Tom Hanks was the AIDS-infected lawyer who sued his firm after being fired for suffering from such a stigmatized illness. And Bruce, of course, won top honors for this song. Let's listen to it and talk a little bit more about the Streets of Philadelphia.
I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. I saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh brother, you're gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia.
Streets of Philadelphia. Oh, that song just gets to you, doesn't it? And they opened the envelope, and it was Best Original Song at the Academy Awards.
Yeah. No, that was a huge deal for Bruce. I mean, I think the song obviously meant a lot to him. I mean, you can feel that, you know.
Yes.
Yourself. You know, it's a very, very powerful song, very mm-hmm. empathetic and warm, and, you know, and that's, a lot of that, I mean, talking again about his childhood and that sense of his own family's removal from the mainstream and feeling, you know, completely separate from society and looked down upon. And, you know, I think that's something, again, that doesn't leave you. I mean, people have said over the years, as Bruce has become more successful and yet maintained his connection to the working class and where he's from, you know, there's some people who say, well, that couldn't be real. That's got to be phony now because he's so rich and he's a huge cloistered star. But on the other hand, you know, I think when you experience things as a young child and your identity gets built around being this outsider character, being less than other people, you know, that doesn't leave you. It doesn't, you know, just because you get a big check or you move into a big house or whatever, that doesn't change those kind of primal experiences and those primal, you know, that sense of yourself. And I think, you know, when Bruce wakes up every morning, I mean, I think a lot of him is still that poor, mm-hmm. you know, sort of victimized kid. And, you know, and so that's, I think a lot of that is where that comes from. I mean, he's talked about, you know, when he sees somebody like, you know, impoverished immigrants trying to work in the country or people who are just trying to hold it together from paycheck to paycheck and, you know, and, or lose their job and, that, you know, don't know how to feed their kids anymore, he understands in a visceral way exactly how that feels. and his sympathy for those people, you know, for people in those dire position is unending. You know, he feels their experience because he's lived it himself.
Yeah, that song is just so haunting. It just makes you weep. Let's go to a Facebook comment. Hank writes, is it true that he no longer plays Born in the USA in concert?
No, that's not true. He doesn't play that often, but he'll play it. For whatever reason, it's fallen away from. I think, you know, you play a song, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times.
I'm sure.
You know, like from the mid-80s on, and eventually you kind of lose your appetite for it, I guess. You know, you wait for it to, you know, to kind of regain its emotional power for you. But, but he'll whip it out, just not all that consistent.
Mm-hmm. How did you get him to talk so openly to you? That's what makes your book so absolutely wonderful. You had access to this man.
Yeah. That was really cool, too. I didn't start the book with any access and, you know, worked on it for quite a while, just, you know, doing my own research and doing my own thing. But eventually I think that they just became, Bruce and his manager became aware of, you know, increasingly aware that I was out there and began to hear back, I think, from people telling them, you know, how I struck them while speaking to them and the kind of questions I was asking and, you know, what I really seemed to be looking for. And I think that they felt encouraged by that. And I think also, you know, from what Bruce has said, I mean, that there was, you know, his sense that I was really working as, you know, doing a kind of shoe leather version of the book and spending a lot of time in New Jersey and hanging out with, you know, folks that he knew. You know, I think it was just a question of, you know, he felt like he wanted to honor that,
yes,
the amount of labor and, you know, I'd put into it, which was great. Obviously, I was delighted.
It sure was great. Yeah, it was great. Peter Ames Carlin, his book is Bruce. We'll take more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network.
Turning shore as the rising sun. Now get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything that they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown.
From his latest album, Wrecking Ball, Death to Our Hometown. As you look at the whole course of his career and you listen to that particular song, Peter, is there something really different about it, or do most all of his albums come from the same place of his youth, really? Come from the same place of his hometown, or is there something different here?
Well, you know, I mean, there's always a little bit different on his record. You know, each record that comes out, I think he's very conscious of putting something new or adding a new dimension to it. In this case, that record, Wrecking Ball, which that song, Death to My Hometown, comes off of, it just came out last year, is, you know, it's an interesting song. I mean, lyrically, it evokes a lot of the same themes that he's, you know, discussed over, you know, a lot of records, you know, that, again, that sense of hometown and being kind of overrun by rapacious outsiders. But in this case, I mean, what's interesting about that song to me is how Irish it is. You know?
Yes, isn't it?
He's flirted with a lot of different styles and folk styles over the years and just regular, you know, rock and roll, rhythm and blues,
uh-huh.
You know, anthemic stuff, you know, I mean, and folky stuff and all that kind of stuff. In this case, he's taking a lot of his folk. What was interesting to me about that whole album is, you know, he takes these sort of folk instrumentation and folk styles, but then weaves them together with, you know, modern dance rhythms and synthesized things. And, you know, so it's a weirdly powerful, rocking acoustic record in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it.
Song, the Irish thing, I mean, the Irish are run thick in his family. His grandmother on his father's side was came from an Irish family named the Garrities. And, you know, they moved to Freehold, New Jersey in the mid-19th century. And the first thing they did when they bought a house was plant a tree from a seed that they had taken from County Cork. And that was the house that Bruce spent his first, you know, his grandparents' house. He spent his first 5, 6, 7 years in. And that influence and you know, the relatives on that side of the family made a huge impression on him. And you can hear it, you know, he's really sort of become, I think, more transfixed by that part of his heritage.
Mm-hmm. Well, the course of our lives, there's something, aren't they? Let's go to Jeff in Madison next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Yeah, 75, when I heard him, Born to Run, you played that. It's still my favorite song. About 24 years ago at Rosemont down by Chicago, I saw, and he did play 4 hours. We timed it when we left because we both had to work the next day, me and my buddy, and it was almost midnight when we got done. They played encore after encore after encore, and that raw feeling you say on stage, to me it's almost like, have you ever been sick like me, put your hand in a fan, just down.
Yeah.
It's just a little game you do. You get excited about it, but you're almost afraid to do it when they're at their concerts. They're so powerful. And
yeah.
The other thing, they're, his artist, you think Clarence Clemens, you know,
yes.
Rest in peace, but Nils Lofgren, Lil Steve, and Max Weinberg, and then, you know, even Patti.
Alpha.
She had that little bit of career and stuff, so he had some powerful people with him. And then a question I have for you is, I thought I heard back in the early or the mid-70s that Rolling Stone or something wrote that he was going to be the next Bob Dylan, so... Thanks.
Thanks sure. so much for your memories here. Peter?
Yeah. Well, the E Street Band is a fantastic band. And, you know, and the interesting thing about them is that, you know, when Bruce was amassing this band, you know, he wasn't necessarily looking for the greatest technical players, per se, you know, the guys that were super whizzes on each instrument, but for guys who had a particular feel together, you know, who could play with a kind of emotional connection and understanding to understand, you know, the real power in the music, you know, the emotional heart of the songs, and, you know, and be able to communicate, help him communicate what he needed to say. You know, and you know, it turned out that they were excellent musicians on their own terms, by and large, but also just very special players, and they all, you know, had incredible personalities and added,
right,
you know, added a lot to his performance. But he, you know, and that's really part of the thing. I mean, he gets great players to play with him in other situations. But there's something about that group and about the relationships and what they symbolize in his life, which is, you know, really adds something huge to the power of the shows.
It sure does. Bill is next in Appleton. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call, Kathleen.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Two comments. Number one, I think one of the loveliest songs and greatest songs he ever wrote, in my opinion, of course, humble as it may be, is Jungle Land, especially with the haunting sax solo by the late, great Clarence Clemens. And then secondly, I had heard quite a bit about when Nils Lofgren had joined the band as one of the guitarists. And Nils used to do some theatrics on stage, like backflips and everything else, and then Bruce started getting into it until the managers and the insurance people were a little concerned about either one of them falling or hurting themselves seriously, so they kind of backed off doing that.
All right, we have about 15 seconds.
On that.
Sure, Peter, 15 seconds.
Yeah, well, Nils was a gymnast before, you know, he really devoted himself to music, so he can do all kinds of amazing things. Bruce has always been very physical, a lot of jumping up onto the pianos and on amps and leaping around and jumping off the stage. But that's just, you know, again, that's just part of his communion with the crowd, and that's really what it's all about for him.
Mm-hmm. Peter, thank you so much. The hour just went by. I'm looking up, and oh, my gosh, we got to say goodbye.
My pleasure. It was really fun. Thank you for having me.
It was fun. Thank you, Peter. Peter Ames Carlin, his book is Bruce. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, and thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air answering of calls. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be with you again on Monday. Here's the boss.